Track 7.
The Seraph stood in towards the land in the dark of the moon. It was 2 nights after Hal and Tom's landing and fortuitous escape from the island. Silently, the Seraph glided the last mile, and then, at Hal's quiet order to the helm, she turned into the light breeze and hove to. Hal crossed to the weather rail and listened intently. The booming of the surf on the outer beaches of Flor de la Mar was faint but unmistakable. "We're about a mile offshore," Ned Tyler confirmed Hal's own estimate. "Launch the boats," Hal ordered. "I leave you in charge of the ship, Mr. Tyler. Hold your station here and await our signal."
"Aye, Captain, and good luck, sir."
The boats were lined up on the open deck. One after the other, they were swung out and dropped to the surface of the water alongside. Then the armed men went down into them quickly and quietly and took their places on the rowing benches. As Hal went to the rail and the ladder, Tom was waiting for him. He was hunched over the crutch that one of the carpenters had made for him.
"Would that I were coming with you, father," he burst out. "I would gladly cut off this leg of mine to do so."
He stamped the crutch on the deck in frustration. Dr. Reynolds had determined that although the bone was not broken, Tom would not be able to walk on it for many weeks.
"We could have found use for your strong right arm, Tom," Hal told him. He had forgiven his son's disobedience, which had placed them all in such danger. "Will you try to find Dorry?"
"You know that we're only attacking the shipping in the bay. After the other night, Al-Auf must know we're in the offing, and his men will be on the alert. Without the advantage of surprise, we could never hope to carry the fort with so few men."
"I am mad with worrying about what those swines are doing to poor Dorry."
"So are we all. But once we have seized or burned Al-Auf's ships, we will have him trapped on the island. He won't be able to escape with Dorian. Then, when Captain Anderson returns with the yeoman, we will have sufficient strength to storm the fort. We must contain ourselves until then."
"I pray to God that the yeoman returns swiftly."
"Yes, lad, pray. That never hurt anyone. But in the meantime, we will reinforce your prayers with a little powder and steel," said Hal grimly, and went down into the waiting pinnace. They pushed off from the Seraph's side, Hal leading the flotilla in the first pinnace. Big Daniel had command of the second, and Alf Wilson was in charge of the 2 longboats. Behind them, the Seraph came on the wind under shortened sails, prepared to wait out the long hours until the men returned. The oars of the small boats were muffled, and the crews enjoined to strict silence as they crept in towards the island. Hal navigated by compass, stopping every once in a while to listen for the sound of the surf. Each time it was louder, and then the men in the bows pointed ahead. Hal jumped up on the stern sheets and picked out the bright speckling of fires which marked the encampment below the walls of the fort. He realized at once that the current had pushed them down towards the south and altered course to head for the pass through the coral reef into the bay. Hal could almost smell the nervous tension in the crew of the pinnace. For all fighting seamen, there was a peculiar allure in the cutting out of an enemy ship from a protected anchorage. This bearding of the lion was an English specialty, as innovation of men like Drake, Frobisher, and Hawkins. Hal had enough men to take out only 2 of the ships he had seen in the bay. He and Abberley had studied them all carefully from the beach, and though it had been dark, the moon had given him light enough to make his selection. First, of course, had been the Minotaur, though she had been badly neglected in the hands of the corsairs and severely damaged in her short encounter with the Seraph, she was still a well-found vessel of great value. Hal estimated she would be worth £10,000 when he tied her up in London. He had no way of knowing how much of her cargo remained on board, but it might be considerable. The other ship he had selected was a Dutchman that clearly had been pirated from the VOC. She was a big-bottomed vessel built in the Rotterdam style that would fetch as much as the Minotaur. If he could bring both ships out, it would mean £20,000 for the night's work. He leaned forward in his seat at the tiller and whispered to the men nearest him.
"There's £20 a man lying there in the bay for the picking. Pass that along."
They chuckled fiercely and turned on the thwarts to send the message down the length of the pinnace. "There's nothing like the smell of gold to raise a bloodthirst in an English seaman," Hal thought, and smiled to himself in the dark.
It was a great shame that he could not bring out the other craft. Two more tall ships and a dozen dhows of varying shapes and sizes would add nicely to the bag, but he would have to settle for the smell of the smoke of their funeral pyres. As they approached the pass through the reef, the other boats moved into a single column behind him to follow him through. This was where the entire expedition could end before it had begun, in bloody disaster. He had only his father's chart and his own instinctive seamanship to carry them through. He stood as high as he could on the thwart and stared ahead. He was watching the snore of the surf curling white on the murderously jagged spikes of the reef, picking out the dark spot towards the north end where the deeper water remained unbroken. "Start the lead," he whispered, and heard the plop as it was thrown out ahead of the bows. Seconds later came the soft call of the leadsman. "No bottom with this line." They were still beyond the drop-off. Suddenly there was a startled cry from the bows, and Hal looked ahead. He saw a large dhow coming down the channel directly towards them, her triangular sail catching the moonlight, and her wake leaving a long, glossy slick through the passage. She was on a collision course with the pinnace. Hal had a moment's temptation. She was a large vessel, and she was almost certainly stuffed with treasure she had traded from Al-Auf. She was unsuspecting and vulnerable. It would take only minutes to board her and subdue her crew. Five of his men could sail her out to where the Seraph waited. Hal hesitated. If they could take her cleanly, it would be gold in the purse of every man-jack on the Seraph. But if they ran into resistance, and there was a fight on her deck, the sounds of the struggle would carry to the corsairs on the beach. Take her or let her go? Hal had only seconds in which to decide. He glanced beyond the oncoming dhow into the heart of the bay and saw the bare masts of the Minotaur stand tall and proud against the stars. Then he looked back at the oncoming dhow. Let her go. He made the fateful decision, and aloud he whispered to his crew, "Vast heaving!" The rowers held their beat, and the tips of their long oars dragged over the surface, taking the way off her, until she lay quiet and low in the dark waters. Behind her, the other boats conformed to her example. The big dhow made the final turn out through the passage. Unchecked and unmolested, she swept past where the pinnace lay. A lookout on her deck spotted them and hailed them in Arabic. "What boat are you?" "Fishing boats with the night's catch," Hal pitched his voice so that it would not carry to the shore. "What boat are you?" "The ship of Prince Abn Mumud al-Malik." "Go with Allah," Hal called after her, as she bore away into the west and disappeared on the dark plains of the ocean. "Haul away," he ordered, and watched the long oars sweep forward and dip, swing and rise in unison, dripping liquid fire from their tips. He aimed the bows for the exact spot where the big dhow had come through. By the mark, 10. The lead had found bottom. Sir Francis's chart was proved accurate once again, confirmed for Hal by the passage of the dhow. They rowed on into the gap. Suddenly water was breaking on either side of them. By the mark, 5. They were entering the throat. "Drop the number one buoy," Hal ordered. The leadsman in the bows let it go over the side, and the line attached to the small white-painted keg peeled out. Hal looked round and saw the keg bobbing in their wake. It would give him his marks when he brought out the captured Minotaur. He turned back and squinted at the walls of the fort, which showed pale in the moonlight, lining them up with the tip of the reef. "Now," he muttered, and made the first turn of the dogleg. The other boats followed him round. "By the mark, 4.5 4. "Too close to the outer reef." Hal altered course slightly to keep down to the centre of the channel. Suddenly, there was suppressed urgency in the voice of the man on the lead. "By the mark, 2. With that warning, Hal picked up the shape of the coral, dark and menacing as some monster dead ahead. He put the tiller hard over, bringing her round only just in time, for they had almost overrun the channel. "By the mark, 7. There was relief in the leadsman's tone. They had passed through the coral jaws and were into the open harbour where the unsuspecting enemy ships lay. "Drop the number 2 buoy,"
Hal whispered, and they left it standing in the middle of the pass to mark their way out. He glanced back over his shoulder. The other boats were fanning out. He had given each of them their targets. Hal would take the Minotaur. In the second pinnace, Big Daniel would take the Dutchman, and the longboats would attack and burn all the other craft in the anchorage. Hal steered for the big East Indiaman, where she lay in the deepest water directly opposite the fort. "Let us find out how bright-eyed is her anchor watch," he thought, as he waited for the first alarm to be given. But the Minotaur stood tall and dark and silent as they came up under her quarter and hooked onto her chains. Abberley went first, swinging up over the side. With the double-headed axe in one hand, he landed on the deck, his bare feet making almost no sound, and ran forward lightly while a rush of men followed him up from the pinnace. Halfway down the deck, a watchman struggled to his feet from where he had been lying asleep under the gunwale. He was unsteady on his feet, and obviously only half awake. "Who are you?" His voice was sharp with alarm. "I know you not!" He grabbed for the musket that leaned against the gunwale beside him. "Go with God," said Abberley, and swung the axe in a wide, flashing arc. It took the man full in the side of his neck, severing it cleanly. His head toppled forward and rolled down his chest, while his trunk stood erect before it slumped to the deck. The air escaped from his lungs in a whistling blast of frothy blood from the open windpipe. Abberley jumped over the corpse, and with a dozen long strides reached the anchor cable stretched tautly through its hawsehole. He looked back over his shoulder and saw that Hal was already at the helm. The rest of the Minotaur's skeleton crew had been subdued without any outcry, and their robed bodies were scattered along the open deck. Looking upwards, he saw that most of the Seraph seamen were swarming up the rigging and swinging out along the yards. The Minotaur had been built in the same yard as the Seraph, and the rigging of her masts was almost identical. There was no hesitation in the way the topmastmen did their work. As the main course spread, like the wings of a butterfly emerging from the chrysalis sheath, Abberley swung the axe high above his head and with both hands brought the blade flashing down again. The axe buried itself with a thump in the deck timber, and the anchor cable parted with a twang. The Minotaur paid away before the night breeze, until the rudder and push of the spreading sails checked her. Hal spun the wheel full to starboard, and lightly as a lover, the Minotaur came on the wind. Only then could Hal spare a glance for the other boats of the flotilla. There was fighting on the deck of the Dutchman, and he heard the tinny clank of cutlass blade on scimitar, then the faint death cry of a man hit through the heart. The sails spread on the yards, and the big ship turned for the bay entrance. At that moment there was a flicker of light which grew swiftly in strength until it lit the deck of the Minotaur. Hal could make out Abberley's features clearly as he strode down the deck towards him. He swung round and saw that the square-rigged ship closest to him was on fire. The men from the longboat, commanded by Alf Wilson, had climbed aboard her, killed her crew, and tossed tar-soaked torches into her holds and rigging. The flames caught in her hull and jumped up into the rigging. The fire raced up as though it were gunmatch, tracing fiery strings against the dark sky. It reached the furled canvas on her yards and exploded in a tall, writhing tower of light, higher than the palm trees on the beach. Alf's men tumbled back into the longboat and rowed lustily across to the next ship in the anchorage, whose crew saw them coming and did not linger to greet them. They fired a few wild shots at them, then threw aside their weapons and jumped over the ship's side, hitting the water in a series of white splashes and swimming frantically for the beach. One after the other, the anchored ships burst into flame and lit the anchorage as though it were noon. The shadows and light played vividly over the walls of the fort, and the first cannon shot banged out from the battlements. Hal did not see where the ball struck, for he was bringing the Minotaur around and lining her up for the entrance. The keg they had left floating to mark the passage stood out clearly in the firelight, and the flames were so bright that he could even make out the loom of the reef beneath the surface. "Ready about!" Hal bellowed, and began the delicate manoeuvre of tacking ship with so few men in the confines of the bay. There was no latitude for error here. One false turn would put them up on the beach, or send the Minotaur crunching into the coral. He was towing the pinnace behind the ship,
and its weight and drag affected the Minotaur's handling. He would have to allow for this when he made his turn. The Minotaur was heading directly towards the fort, and in the dancing light of the flames, Hal could see the gunners scurrying to their weapons. Before he had reached the keg that marked the entrance, a cannon fired, then another. He saw a clean round hole appear miraculously in the mainsail as a ball flew through it, and realized that the gunners had made no effort to depress their aim. All their shots were flying high. He glanced back over the stern and saw that Big Daniel, in the Dutchman, was following only a cable length behind. He was towing his pinnace too. They would leave no consolation prize for the enemy. Deeper in the bay, the longboats had completed their work of destruction, and every enemy ship was on fire. The anchor cable of one of the big square-rigged vessels burned through, and she began to drift towards the beach, a moving bonfire. Suddenly the fire reached her powder magazine, and she blew up with a thunderous roar. Her mainmast was hurled aloft like a javelin, and as it fell back it skewered one of the small dhows, smashing cleanly through her decks, so that the bottom was torn out of her, and she sank stern first. The shockwave of the explosion capsized two of the dhows nearest her and raised a tidal wave that swept through the anchorage. Hal searched for sight of the longboats, worried that they had been overwhelmed by the force of the explosion. But then he saw them, bobbing and rolling in the disturbed waters, but making good speed to catch up with the Minotaur as their crews heaved frantically on the oars. Hal turned all his attention to taking the ship out through the channel. He passed the marker keg by an oar's length on the port side, and they entered the mouth of the pass at speed, passing close under the guns on the battlements of the fort. Hal had a few seconds before the next turn came upon them, and he looked up at the batteries above. Some of the gunners seemed to have realized their error and were training their pieces down. Hal saw the angle of the protruding barrels depressing as they strained at the training tackles. "Stand by the main course," Hal told his tiny crew. Each man was forced to do the work of three, but when he put up the helm and shouted, "Lee ho!" they jumped to it with a shout and a will. The Minotaur came round handily and glided down the passage between the menacing arms of coral, disaster lurking close on either hand. Hal looked back and saw Big Daniel make the same turn in the slick path of the Minotaur's wake. "Stout fellow," Hal applauded him under his breath. The battery on the walls behind him was firing furiously. The gun smoke was a thick rolling bank through which the flashes of the bombardment cut long bright shafts. The gunners had managed to lower their barrage now, and a ball raised a gleaming fountain of spray close under the Minotaur's counter. Hal smiled wolfishly. The turn was taking the ship almost directly away from the fort, and now the cannon shots were flying too low. It would take the gunners some time to realize this, and by then Hal hoped to be clear of the pass and bearing out into the open sea. "Ready about!" he yelled, as he saw the number one marker boy dancing in the firelight directly ahead. One of his seamen ran to take his place at the mainsheet. As he passed within arm's length of where Hal stood, a chance shot from the battery hit them. There was a blast of disrupted air that almost threw Hal off his feet. He had to clutch with both hands at the spokes of the wheel for support. The stone ball, reeking of the powder fumes that had sent it on its way, struck the running seaman high in his back. It mangled his body and popped his skull, so that half of his brains were flung into Hal's face like a mugful of warm custard. Hal gagged and recoiled at the horror of it, so distracted as almost to misjudge the final turn. At the last moment he gathered himself, wiped the running yellow mess from his face, and shouted, with a sickening taste on his lips, "Let go your courses!" and put the wheel hard over. The Minotaur came round, skimming the edge of the coral, and lifted her bows to the first swell of the open sea. As the reef fell away behind him, Hal turned anxiously to watch Big Daniel negotiate the last turn. He made a neater job of it than Hal had. The Dutchman switched her fat bottom round, heeled slightly to the change in the angle of the wind, and then, with all the aplomb and dignity of a dowager following her more agile and skittish daughter, came trundling after the Minotaur into the deep open waters. "We're through," Hal said softly, then raised his voice in a triumphant shout. We made it, lads. Give yourself a cheer.
They hooted and howled like mad dogs, and from the ship that followed Big Daniel's men cheered as wildly. In the longboats they jumped on the thwarts and danced and capered until they were in danger of capsizing. The guns of the battery banged away in frustration, a futile, fading accompaniment, and the flames of the burning fleet began to subside as they sailed out to meet the waiting Seraph.
As dawn broke next morning, the squadron of Hal's ships lay hove to 10 miles southwest of Flor de la Mar. Hal came on deck, having changed only his shirt, and gobbled down an early breakfast just as the sun pushed its upper rim above the horizon. When Hal looked across at her from the quarterdeck of the Seraph, the Minotaur's blemishes were apparent in the brilliant early sunlight. She was shot-ridden and neglected, her sails ragged and discoloured, her hull stained and battered. She rode high and light in the water. A cursory examination the previous night had disclosed that her hold was empty of all cargo, but her magazine was almost full of munitions, and the powder kegs seemed in good condition. These stores would stand Howell in good stead when the time came to make his final assault on Al-Auf's beleaguered stronghold. Yet despite her appearance, the Minotaur needed only small attention, and work upon her to restore her to first-class condition. Howell had no reason to revise his opinion of her value. She was worth at least £10,000 of prize money, of which his personal share would be close to 3,000. He smiled with satisfaction, and turned the lens of his telescope on the other prize they had taken the previous night. There was no doubt at all that she was a VOC ship, just as Howell had surmised. Through the glass he read her name in gold letters on her transom, Dilam, which translated as the Lamb. Howell thought it described her well. She looked plump and docile, yet her lines were solid and workmanlike, appealing to his sailor's eye. She was newly built, and had not been long enough in the hands of the corsairs to suffer degradation. The hatches were still on her cargo hold, but from her depth in the water it was clear that she was still fully laden. Her cargo had not been taken ashore by Al-Auf. "Call away the longboat, Mr. Tyler," Howell snapped shut his telescope. "I'm going across to visit Mr. Fisher on the Lamb and see just what we have captured." Big Daniel met him at the entry port of the Dutch ship with a wide, toothless grin. "Congratulations, Captain. She's a beauty." "Well done yourself, Mr. Fisher. I could have asked for no more from you and your rascals." He smiled around at the grinning seamen who pressed close behind Big Daniel. "All of you will have bulging purses when you step ashore on Plymouth Hoe." They cheered him raucously. "How many of your brave lads were killed?" Hal lowered his voice as he touched on such a morbid subject. Daniel answered loudly. "Not a single one, praise God, though young Peter here lost a finger, shot away. Show the captain, lad." The young sailor held up the stump of his forefinger, swathed in a grubby rag. "I will add an extra gold guinea to your prize money," Hal promised him, "to help soothe the pain." "At that price, you can have the other four fingers as well, Captain." The seaman grinned hugely, and his mates hooted with laughter as they went back to their stations. Big Daniel led Hal forward. "We found these still chained in her forecastle." He indicated the band of strangers in rags who huddled by the foremast. "They are the survivors of the Dutch crew. 23 lovely little cheeseheads, all consigned by Al-Auf to the slave markets." Hal looked them over quickly. They were thin, but not emaciated, and though the galls left by their chains were obvious on ankles and wrists, and there were weals on their backs and limbs which had been laid upon them with the Arab kiboko, they seemed in reasonable health. Like the Lamb, they had not been long enough in captivity to have suffered too severely. "It is your lucky day, young'uns," Hal greeted them in Dutch. "You are free men again." At that, their faces brightened. Hal was delighted to have them. With two extra prize ships to handle, he would need every man he could find. "Will you sign up with me for the rest of the voyage for a guinea a month and a share of the prize?" he asked. Their smiles expanded, and their acceptance was wholehearted. "Are any of you officers?" Hal asked. "No, Mynheer," their spokesman replied. Our Captain Van Order and all his officers were murdered by that heathen scum. I was Captain's coxswain. You will retain your rank, Hal told him. All these men are under your command. If he kept all the Dutchmen together, the language problem would be solved. Then again, Big Daniel had learned to speak Dutch well while they were in captivity at Good Hope. They are your little lambs, Mr. Fisher, Hal said. Let them put their marks on the quarterbill and give them fresh clothing from the slop chest. And now let's see what we have caught ourselves here. He led the way down to the captain's quarters in the stern. The main cabin had been looted by the corsairs. The captain's desk and lockers had been broken open and ransacked. Every item of value had been stolen. The ship's books and papers were littered over the deck, trampled and torn, although many were still legible. Hal retrieved the log and the cargo manifest from among the mess. One glance at the manifest made him whistle with surprise and delight. By God! If all this is still in her holds, then the lamb is a treasure indeed. He was about to show Big Daniel a stiff sheet of parchment, but remembered that he could not read, was sensitive about this, and instead said, "Tea from China, Mr. Fisher. She's crammed with it, enough to swamp every coffee house in London." He laughed and repeated the slogan he had seen above the front door of Garway's coffee house in Fleet Street. "That excellent and by all physicians approved China drink. Tea."
"Is it worth anything, Captain?" Big Daniel asked lugubriously.
"Worth anything?" Hal laughed at him. "Probably more than its own weight in silver bars, Danny."
He flipped through the ledger to the final tally of the manifest.
"To be precise, it was worth 123,692 guilders on the quay at Jakarta, twice as much in London. Say 30,000 guineas as a rough estimate. More than the lamb herself." At noon that same day, Hal called all his officers on board the Seraph to receive their orders. "We are going to be stretched to the limit for men to work all three ships," he told them, as they assembled in the stern cabin. "I am sending the Minotaur and the Lamb with skeleton crews south to the Glorieta Islands to make their rendezvous with Captain Anderson in the Yeoman. Mr. Fisher will have the Lamb and overall command." He glanced at Big Daniel and thought, "By God, I shall miss him. Mr. Wilson will have command of the Minotaur." Alf Wilson bowed his gypsy dark head in acknowledgement. "Grand Glorieta is 230 sea miles from here. Not too far. There is a safe anchorage at the south end of the island, and fresh water in the creek there. I will give you four of the carpenters to undertake the repairs to the Minotaur and to get her back into fighting trim. That will be your first concern."
"Aye, Captain," Big Daniel nodded.
"By my calculations, the Yeoman should arrive at the rendezvous within the next 3 weeks. As soon as she does, you are to leave the Lamb anchored at Grand Glorieta with a skeleton crew aboard, and if the Minotaur is repaired by then, you will bring her and Captain Anderson back here to take part in the assault on Flor de la Mar."
"I understand, Captain," Big Daniel answered. "When do you want me to leave, sir?"
"As soon as you possibly can, Mr. Fisher. Captain Anderson may already be waiting at the rendezvous. With Dorian a prisoner on Flor de la Mar, every day is precious. I shall remain here to keep Al Aouf blockaded." Standing alone on the quarterdeck of the Seraph, while the sunset incarnadined the western sky, Hal watched the Minotaur and the Lamb detach and head off into the south. As the shapes of the two ships dwindled with distance and were at last engulfed by the gathering shades of dusk, Hal gave the order to take the Seraph back to her station off Flor de la Mar. In the first rays of the next day's sunrise, Hal sailed his ship boldly across the entrance to the bay, just out of range of the guns on the walls of the fort. His purpose was to warn Al Aouf that he was under blockade, and at the same time to survey the island thoroughly. Through the lens of the telescope, the consternation in the Arab camp was clear to see. A throng of corsairs abandoned the huts and lean-to shelters among the palms and swarmed up to the shelter of the fort. The great teak doors swung shut before all had passed through, and those left outside clamoured and beat at the door with fists and muskets. Hal was pleased to see how undisciplined they were. Their lack of training and control had been just as apparent in their wild gunnery.
Hal could make out the turbaned heads of the gunners above the top of the wall as they rushed to man the cannon. The first shot boomed out, and the ball struck the surface of the sea, halfway between the shore and the Serif. It skipped along the surface, slowing with each bounce until it was quite clear to the eye. Half a cable's length from the Serif, it plunged below the surface and disappeared. Then the rest of the battery opened up. Soon the walls of the fort were hazed with a fog of gun smoke, and plumes of seawater rose like a forest between the shore and the ship. The Serif was still well out of range. Hal had overestimated the range of the Arab ordnance. He switched his attention to the anchorage. No ships were left lying in the bay, not even the smallest fishing dhow. Their attack had swept it clean. Charred wreckage littered the surface and lay thickly along the high-water mark of the beach. The burned-out hull of the three-masted ship lay high and dry, canted over to expose her bottom, the masts burned out of her. "She'll never go to sea again," Ned Tyler remarked with satisfaction. "You've got that rat bottled up in his hole, Captain." "Yes, our next trick is to winkle him out," Hal declared. "Send Master Tom to me." Tom came sliding down the backstay of the foremast and hobbled across on his injured foot. It seemed to be healing more speedily than Dr. Reynolds had predicted. Hal watched him come down the deck with a critical eye. Tom was taller now than most of the other men on board, with the wide shoulders and brawny arms of a swordsman. His hair had not felt the scissors since they had sailed from England, and it hung down his back, thick and curling, dark like a horse's tail. Recently, Hal had given him a straight razor, so his cheeks were clean, but darkly tanned. He had the Courtney nose and piercing green eyes. A likely lad, Hal thought. It seemed that since he had lost Dorian, his paternal feelings had become sharper, more intense, and he had to dam back the flood of sentiment that threatened to overwhelm him. He handed the telescope to Tom and said gruffly, "Point out to me the exact spot where you climbed the walls of the fort and the opening of Dorian's cell." They gazed across the water at the island. The barrage of cannon fire still raged, and the thick bank of drifting gun smoke resisted the efforts of the monsoon wind to sweep it aside. "The northwestern corner," Tom pointed. Do you see the clump of three taller palms? Directly above them there is a notch in the wall with the green bushes growing out of it, and it's the first loophole to the left of that. I think that's the one, though I cannot be absolutely certain." Hal took back the telescope and gazed through it at the fortifications. With the early sunlight slanting across the walls, the slits formed by the loopholes were in shadowy contrast to the coral-white blocks. He gazed at the one Tom had indicated, and felt that his loss was almost too painful to be endured. "If you put me back on the island again with Aberley and a small party of good men," Tom began earnestly. Hal cut him off with a curt shake of the head. "No, Tom." He had lost one son. He would not chance losing another. "I know exactly where to find Dorry," Tom pleaded. "There are any number of places where we'd be able to climb the walls."
"They would be expecting you."
"We can't just do nothing," Tom's voice rose passionately. "God alone knows what will become of Dorry if we don't get him out of their clutches."
"We will go in as soon as we are certain of success. In the meantime, Al-Auf will not hurt Dorian. It seems some religious legend is protecting him, a prophecy about an Islamic saint."
I don't understand. A prophecy and Dorry? How do you know that, Father?
From Wazari, the Arab captain we intercepted. It's Dorian's red hair. Legend has it that the prophet Muhammad had red hair. It's rare among the peoples of the East, and they hold it in superstitious esteem.
"But we can't rely on the colour of Dorry's hair."
"That's enough now, Tom. Go back to your battle station." Hal's expression was not unkind, and it took all his good sense and determination to resist the lad's entreaties. The Serif drew away from the fort, and gradually the guns fell silent, while smoke drifted away on the wind. Hal put her on the other tack, and they rounded the north point, slowly beginning a circuit of the island. He scrutinised every feature of the shore, coming in as close as was prudent to the edge of the reef. Hal had made a fair copy of Sir Francis's old chart, and it was now spread out beside the binnacle. On it he made notes of his own observations, besides those noted by his father 50 years previously. He put a leadsman in the chains to take the soundings, and once he launched the longboat and sent Abberley inshore to investigate a lead through the coral. Abberley almost reached the beach on the far side of the lagoon before a party of 100 or more Arabs appeared out of the palm forest, and from close range opened a heavy musket fusillade on the longboat. One of the rowers was wounded in the shoulder before Abberley could bring them out through the passage again. By the time he had completed the circuit of the island, Hal had picked out 12 places where he could put a landing party ashore, and he marked them carefully on the chart. When they came opposite the bay once more, he hove to and made a detailed examination of all he could see of the fortifications and the outworks that the Arabs had thrown up around the foot of the walls. He tried to make some estimate of the number of men that Al-Auf had under his command. Finally, he decided that it was at least 1,000, but knew that the true figure might be twice that. Every few minutes the telescope in his hands seemed to take on a life of its own and swivel back to the loophole in the thick white walls Tom had pointed out to him. "It's going to be a long, weary wait until Edward Anderson gets here," he predicted gloomily. And every man on the Seraph settled down into the monotonous routine of blockade. Hal tried to keep the men alert by constant drilling with muskets and cutlass and cannon, but still the days dragged by. 4 times during the weeks that followed, the monotony was broken when they spotted vessels approaching Flor de la Mar from the west. Each time the Seraph piled on all sail, and the monsoon behind her raced down to intercept them. 3 proved easy prey, and were overhauled and boarded without any loss. However, the 4th vessel was a beautiful 130-foot dhow, not much smaller than the Seraph herself. She led the Seraph on a glorious chase, showing a startling turn of speed, and was handled adroitly by her terrified crew. The Seraph almost lost her when darkness fell. However, Hal outguessed the dhow's captain, and in darkness doubled back towards the island. At daybreak, the dhow was discovered trying to sneak into the bay at Flor de la Mar. The Seraph pounced and cut her off only 1/2 mile short of her goal. Her crew put up a stout fight, and one of Hal's men was shot dead, while 3 others were wounded before they carried her decks. It turned out that she was owned by Prince Abd Muhammad al-Malik. The prince was not on board, but his personal cabin was furnished like the throne room of an Oriental potentate. Hal had the carpets and furniture stripped from the bulkheads and taken to his own cabin in the Seraph. The prince's name was familiar to Hal. He recalled clearly the other ship they had hailed on the night they had cut out the Minotaur and the Lamb from the bay of Flor de la Mar, and that he had deliberately let go. She had belonged to the same man, and now that Hal was presented with such evidence of great riches, he doubted the wisdom of that decision. He ordered a rope reeved at the masthead and the noose placed over the head of the dhow's captain. Standing at the condemned man's side, Hal questioned him at length. "Yes, Effendi," the man was terrified for his life and answered freely. "Al-Malik is a rich and powerful man. He is the younger brother of the Caliph in Muscat. He has more than 100 trading vessels in his fleet. They ply to every port in Africa and India and the lands of the Prophet. We call regularly at Dar el-Shaitan to trade with Jangiri." "You know full well that Al-Auf is a corsair, that all the goods you buy from him have been stolen from Christian ships, that many innocent seamen have been slaughtered by the corsair to win them, and those who survive are sold into slavery. I know only that my master has sent me to trade with Jangiri because the prices of his goods are favourable. As to how he obtained them, that is not my concern or that of my master." "I shall now make it your concern," Hal told him harshly. "By trading with the corsair in stolen goods, you have put yourself in equal guilt." He turned to Abberley. "Search the ship carefully." The 3 dhows they had captured earlier had all been intent on trading with Al-Auf, just as was this captain. It seemed that the news of the magnificent bargains to be had on Dar al-Shaitan had spread from the Persian Gulf to the Coromandel coast. The 3 other ships had been carrying coin and specie to pay for the wares they expected to obtain. "Let's see if this ruffian can make a further contribution to the expense of maintaining the blockade of the island."
Hal paced the deck while his men ransacked the dhow. Within half an hour they had uncovered the hiding place of the captain's money chests. The captain tore at his beard and ripped his robe with anguish when the four chests were dragged onto the deck of the dhow. They were too heavy to carry.
"Have mercy, Effendi," the captain wailed. "That does not belong to me, it belongs to my master."
The man fell to his knees.
"If you take it from me, then you condemn me to my death."
"Which you deserve well enough," Hal told him dryly, then turned back to Aberley. "Is there anything else of value in her holds?"
"She is empty, Gondwani."
"Very well. Take the booty across to the Seraph." Hal faced the wailing dhow captain. "These chests are the price of your freedom and that of your ship. Warn your master that this is but a small part of the price I will extract from him if ever again he is foolish enough to traffic with corsairs. Now, go with God and thank him for your deliverance." From the deck of the Seraph, he watched the dhow scudding away back towards the African mainland. Then he went down to his cabin where Aberley had stacked the captured chests against the bulkhead. "Open them," Hal demanded, and with a crowbar, Aberley ripped away the locks. The three vessels Hal had captured earlier had yielded rich pickings, but those were insignificant in comparison to what was revealed when the lids of the four chests were thrown back. The coin they contained was packed into small canvas bags. Hal slit one open with his dagger, and a stream of glittering gold poured out onto his desktop. He saw at once that most of the coins were Mohurs, each punch-stamped with the three mountains and the elephant of the Mughal Empire. But other coinage was mixed in with them. Gold dinars of the Islamic sultans covered with religious script, a few ancient tetradrachmas of the Persian satraps whose rarity value far surpassed the intrinsic value of the metal.
"It would take 10 men a week to count this hoard," Hal said. "We'll weigh it instead.
Have Mr. Walsh bring down the ship's scales and give him 2 men to help him."
Walsh laboured the rest of that day and half the night before he could bring Hal the final tally.
"It is difficult to obtain a true measure in a moving ship," Walsh told him primly. "The arms of the balance can never come to rest."
"I shall not hold you accountable for an ounce or two each way," Hal assured him. "Give me your honest tally, and I will be content with that until we weigh it at the Court of Assizes in England."
"The weight is 605 pounds, to be precise, or rather to be imprecise."
Walsh chuckled at his own joke, while Hal stared at him in astonishment. He had not expected so much.
By God, that was very close to a lakh of rupees. A vast fortune in any coinage. To that must be added the gold and silver coin he had taken from the 3 other dhows he had captured. Its total value far outstripped the value of the 2 tall ships he had taken as prizes.
"A lakh of rupees," Hal mused aloud, and his eyes went back to the 4 chests with their broken seals standing along the bulkhead. There was something about that particular amount that jogged his memory. "A lakh of rupees. That's the price that Wazari said Al-Auf had placed on the red head of the child of the prophecy. Dorian's slave price." The more he pondered it, the more it seemed feasible. The gold was the purchase money for Dorian. The pleasure this thought gave him far outweighed the gold itself. If Al-Malik was sending gold to Al-Auf to buy Dorian, that proved that his son was still on the island and still contained within his blockade. "Thank you, Mr. Walsh. You have done good work." "I never thought to find the sight of so much gold distasteful." Walsh contemplated the labour of counting it, and Hal went back on deck to resume the endless vigil. "Please God, let Anderson come soon," he whispered, as he looked across the sparkling blue waters at the emerald-green island rimmed with white coral sands, "or at least give me the strength to contain myself." Another week dragged by. Then, one dazzling morning, when the sea lay oily and quiescent, under the stinging assault of the sun, heaving to a slow rhythm, as though it were making love to itself in the breathless heat,
There was a joyous cry from Tom at the masthead.
Sail ho!
Too impatient to wait for the reports from the lookout, Hal clambered up the rigging and squeezed into the crow's nest beside Tom.
There!
Tom pointed to the south. For many minutes, Hal thought he must have been mistaken, for the horizon was deserted. Then he picked out an ephemeral speck that disappeared again immediately. He trained the glass on the spot, and suddenly it was there again, a tiny snowy pinnacle.
You're right, he rejoiced. A square-rigged ship.
Two, Tom corrected him. Two ships. They can only be the Yeoman and the Minotaur. We'll go down to meet them and bid them welcome. Swiftly, the approaching ships resolved into the Yeoman and the Minotaur. Hal examined them eagerly through the telescope and hardly recognized the Minotaur. Big Daniel had worked wonders in the short time he had been given to refit her. She was resplendent under a new coat of paint, and even when she drew closer, there was no sign of the shot damage to her hull or her rigging. On the other hand, the old Yeoman was seaweary and showing all the telltale signs of her long voyage. Hal exchanged flag signals of greeting with her, and when they were alongside each other, both ships hove to, and the Yeoman launched a boat. Edward Anderson's bright red face glowed in the stern like a port lamp as he was rowed across, and he scrambled up the ladder with surprising agility for such a big man. He grasped Hal's outstretched hand. "I hear from Mr. Fisher that you've been hard at work in my absence, Sir Henry, and that you've taken a great prize." His chagrin was apparent in his tone and expression. Only those captains who were in sight of the prize when she was captured were entitled to a share.
"I have urgent employment for your ship, sir, and the promise of even greater treasure in the offing," Hal assured him.
He thought it would be excessively cruel at this stage to mention the booty taken from the Arab dhows. "Come to my cabin." As soon as they were seated, Hal's servant poured a glass of Madeira wine for each of them, then left them alone.
"I bear letters for you from Mr. Beatty and from your son Guy," Captain Anderson told him, and produced the canvas-wrapped package from the folds of his cloak.
Hal laid it aside to be opened and perused later.
"How is Guy?"
The question was casual, for he was anxious to get on with more urgent matters. But still, Anderson's reply startled him.
"He was in good health when last I saw him, but I understand that he is to be married very shortly."
"Good Lord, man, he's only 17 years of age." Hal scowled at him.
"I was not consulted in the matter. You must be mistaken, sir."
"I assure you there is no mistake, Sir Henry." Anderson was even redder in the face than usual, and he moved uncomfortably in the chair.
"Who is the woman?" Hal demanded. "Surely there must be a dearth of young ladies in Bombay?"
He jumped to his feet in his agitation and began to pace the deck, frustrated at the lack of legroom in the tiny cabin, now made even smaller by the lavish furnishings purloined from Al Malik's dhow.
"I am informed that it is Mistress Caroline Beatty."
Edward Anderson pulled a luridly coloured handkerchief from his tunic and mopped his face of the sweat of embarrassment before he could continue. "I am led to believe that there is some urgency in the marriage. In fact, it was set to take place only a day or two after I sailed from Bombay. So your son is almost certainly a married man by this time." Hal came up short as the unsavoury truth started to break in upon him.
"Tom,"
he said aloud.
No, Sir Henry, you misunderstand me. Guy, not Tom.
Forgive me, I was thinking aloud," Hal apologised. The shock had distracted him from the more urgent business, but Anderson brought him back to it with his next remark.
"Mr. Fisher has told me the truly horrifying news that your youngest son has fallen into the hands of the enemy. You have my deepest sympathy, Sir Henry."
"Thank you, Captain Anderson. I shall rely heavily on your help to rescue my boy."
"My ship and crew are entirely at your disposal. That goes without saying."
"Then let us see to our dispositions." Hal had had weeks to make his plans for the assault on Flor de la Mar, and now he laid them out in detail for Anderson. They spent the rest of that day closeted in the stern cabin of the Seraph, going over every detail of the campaign, from the system of flag signals they would use ship to ship and ship to shore, to the disposition of seamen to be used in the assault, and the delegation of the lesser commands to the various officers. Then they pored for another hour over the charts Hal had prepared. The sun was setting before Anderson was ready to go back to the yeoman. "Bear in mind, Captain Anderson, what I have told you. Al-Auf has been ensconced in the fort for some years. All that time, the Arab traders from every corner of the ocean have been drawn to the island like flies to the dung heap. They have brought with them vast quantities of bullion to trade for slaves and stolen goods. The prizes I have captured before your arrival will fade into insignificance in comparison. I believe that on Flor de la Mar we will find a treasure to outweigh anything that Drake or Hawkins ever brought home from their adventures." Edward Anderson's blue eyes twinkled at the thought, and Hal went on to inspire him further. "You will merit a knighthood for your part in this venture, and I will use all my influence with the Honourable Company to see that you obtain it. With your share of the prize, you will be able to afford a fine country estate. After this, you need never put to sea again." They shook hands briefly. "Until tomorrow." Anderson's ruddy features split in a wide grin, and the grip of his huge fist was hearty. "Warn your men that my son is in the fortress." Hal struck a harsher note. "In the heat of the fighting, let there be no mistakes." Hal gave the orders to put the Seraph on course to resume her blockade of the island and returned at once to his cabin. He slit the stitching on the canvas package of letters that Anderson had brought from Bombay. He recognized Guy's spidery handwriting on one of the folded sheets and set it aside to read later. He unfolded the letter from Beatty and frowned as he read it. "The residence? Bombay, 6th day November. Sir Henry. The pleasure I experience in addressing you is somewhat mitigated by the circumstances that make it necessary. Not to put too fine a point on it, my daughter Caroline Beatty has been discovered to be with child. Dr. Goodwin, the surgeon at the factory here in Bombay, puts the duration of her pregnancy at 3 months. This would set a date of conception to the time when my family was lodging ashore at Good Hope. You will recall that your son, Guy Courtney, was with us at the guest house. I am pleased to be able to inform you that your son, Guy Courtney, has behaved in a most gentlemanly fashion in this matter. He has admitted paternity of the child and has asked if he might be allowed to marry my daughter. As he is now above the age of 17 years, he is quite within his legal rights to contract a marriage. My daughter Caroline turns 18 years of age on Friday next, so there is no difficulty as to the ages of the two young people. My wife and I have thought it politic to give our permission to the marriage, and the date has been set down for next Friday, the same date as my daughter's 18th birthday. Thus it is likely that the matter will have been accomplished by the time this epistle comes to your hand. I have been able to provide my daughter with a dowry of £500. The company will set a house in the cantonment at the disposal of the young married couple. Thus their immediate needs will be taken account of. No doubt you will see fit to provide your son with a suitable allowance to eke out his salary, and you will use your considerable influence on the board of governors of the Honourable Company to advance his career. In this respect, I am able to inform you that Guy has settled well into his new employment and has received favourable comment on his efforts from Governor Ungier. My wife joins me in assuring you, sir, of our highest esteem and duty. Your servant, Thurston Beatty." Hal crumpled it in his fist and glared at the letter from Guy, which lay unopened on the desk top. "The idiot! He has laid claim to the bird brought down by Tom's arrow. What in the world could have possessed him?" He tore Beatty's letter into shreds and threw it out of the cabin window, watching the scraps floating away on the ship's wake. Then, with a sigh, he turned his attention to the letter from Guy. It added nothing to what Beatty had already written, except to express Guy's ecstatic joy at his good fortune in having won the hand of the lovely Caroline. "Brother Tom did all the digging to unearth that diamond for you," Hal muttered with disgust, and considered sending for Tom,
informing him as to the fruits of his endeavours and venting his displeasure upon the elder twin. Then he sighed again. To what possible advantage? He asked himself. The deed is done, and all parties seem well enough pleased with the outcome, although nobody seems to have solicited the bride's views on the subject. He bawled Guy's letter, tossed it through the stern window, and watched it bob away until at last it sank, waterlogged, below the surface. At that moment there was a discreet knock on the cabin door, and a seaman called through the panel, "Begging your pardon, Captain, Mr. Tyler sends his compliments, and Flor de Lamar is in sight dead ahead." Hal's domestic problems were, in the instant, submerged as deeply as Guy's sodden missive. He girded on his sword belt and hurried on deck. The Seraph led the Minotaur in line astern across the entrance of the bay. Ned Tyler had command of the Seraph, for Hal was not on board. As the two great ships drew within range, they opened a steady bombardment on the Arab positions among the palm trees and on the walls of the fort. The months of practice that the gun crews had endured now showed to good advantage, and even though their numbers were sorely depleted, their fire was rapid and accurate. Relying on the ineptitude demonstrated by the Arab gunners, Ned brought the Seraph close enough to skirt the outer edge of the reef. He was well within range of the heavy cannon on the walls of the fort, but the Seraph's fire knocked chunks of coral off the battlements and threw the defenders into further disarray. Their return fire was spasmodic and erratic. The attacking ships were well under their guns, and although a few of the huge stone balls they fired fell close enough to throw spray onto the Seraph's decks, most flew well out to sea. The Arab encampment among the groves was within long musket shot of the two ships, and half their fire was directed into the thatched huts and lean-to shelters. The guns were loaded with grapeshot, and the lead balls swept through the throng of men and women who were scurrying for the sheltering walls of the fort. They left swathes of brown bodies lying along the pathway like corn behind the reapers. After the first pass, the ships tacked in succession, then came back again, as close as the reef would allow, their fire unrelenting. By now the Arab gunners had recovered from much of their initial confusion. Their stone balls fell close around the Seraph, and one crashed in through the frail wooden bulwark. It chopped off both legs of one of the powder boys as he came scampering up the companionway from the magazine, laden with the silk bags of black powder. Ned glanced at the boy's legless torso as it writhed in a spreading pool of blood close to where he stood at the helm. The dying boy was calling pitifully for his mother, but both branches of his femoral artery were spurting like open taps, and no man could be called from his duties to render him assistance. The thought of withdrawing beyond the range of the guns in the fort to prevent further losses did not occur to Ned. Hal had asked him to keep the ship close inshore, the shore batteries engaged, and the Arabs bottled up in the fort for as long as he was able. Ned would not flinch from his task, even though he mourned the loss of a single one of his brave lads. On the far side of the island, Hal heard the regular controlled gunfire of the two ships and wiped the sweat from his face with the back of his arm. "Stout fellow," he applauded Ned's determination, then turned all his attention to landing the rest of the men from the Yeomen of York. The boats were coming in through the pass he had marked in the reef so many weeks before. The four pinnaces were packed with men, riding so deeply in the water that they had barely a hand's breadth of free board. As the keel of each boat touched the sand, the men jumped out knee-deep in the clear, warm lagoon water and waded ashore. Big Daniel and Alf Wilson marshalled them into columns and led them off the beach into the shelter of the palm grove. Even with all the men that Anderson could spare from the yeomen, Hal had less than 400 in his landing force to match Al Auf's horde. The enemy might well be more than the 1,000 or two, Hal had estimated, but so far they had not opposed his landing. It seemed that the bombardment by the Seraph and the Minotaur had produced the desired effect of sending all the defenders into the shelter of the fort. The last boatload of seamen came trotting up the beach, heavily laden with weapons, powder flasks and water bottles, for fighting in this heat would be a thirsty business. Hal watched the empty boats rowing back towards the yeomen, which was hovering offshore, not more than half a mile outside the reef, then followed the tail of the marching column
up into the forest. The order of march had been carefully planned. Big Daniel had command of the vanguard, with scouts thrown out ahead to prevent them running into an ambush. There were musket men sent out as flankers on both sides of the column. Hal kept the command of the main body of men under his own hand. It was less than 3 miles from the cove in which they had landed to the fort on the north end, and Hal pushed them hard, keeping up a trot through the soft, sandy footing. They had not covered a mile before there was a volley of musket fire in the forest ahead, and wild cries and screams. Hal hurried forward, fearful that Big Daniel had run into a set ambush, and dreading what he would find. 9 dead Arabs were scattered on both sides of the wide path, trampled by the advancing seamen, and the sounds of the fighting were dwindling among the trees as the remaining Arabs fled back towards the fort, with Daniel's seamen in furious pursuit. A single sailor sat with his back to the trunk of a palm tree, wrapping a strip of cloth around the musket ball wound in his thigh. Hal detailed a man to help him back to the beach, to be taken off by the yeoman, then hurried on after Big Daniel. The guns still boomed and thundered from the far side of the island, and now they were close enough to the fort to see the clouds of gun smoke billowing over the tops of the trees not far ahead. "Ned Tyler is keeping the sons of the Prophet from their prayers," Hal muttered, sweat pouring down his face into his beard and soaking his shirt as though he had stood under a waterfall. For many minutes he had been aware of a foul stench, which was becoming insufferably strong in the humid heat of the forest. When they burst out into open ground, Hal stopped so suddenly that the men who followed him ran into his back. Even in his haste and urgency, he was taken aback by the horrors of Al-Auf's execution ground. The sun-blackened corpses hanging on the tripods were grotesquely bloated with their own stomach gases, and a few had burst open like overripe fruit. They were covered by a moving, iridescent mat of blue flies. Hal could not stop himself from searching the ranks of dead bodies for a smaller one with bright red hair, and felt a swoop of relief in the pit of his stomach when he did not find what he was looking for. He forced himself to go on between the hanging figures and to ignore the clouds of buzzing insects that rose thickly around him and brushed against his face. Abelly and Tom were waiting for him in the trees on the far side of the clearing. "Can we go now?" Tom shouted from a distance of 30 paces. He and Abelly and the 3 men with them were all dressed in Arab robes and headcloths. Hal saw that his son's face was set with determination and impatience, and that his sabre was bared in his right hand. He felt another stab of regret that he had given in to Tom's entreaties and had allowed him to go with Abelly. The one consideration that had influenced him was that Tom was the only man among the attackers who had been on the walls and knew where they could be scaled by a small party of determined men. Tom also knew the cell in which they were holding Dorian. Dressed as corsairs, they would try to reach Dorian and protect him from the fighting and slaughter that would follow the storming of the fort. Hal grabbed Abelly's arm and hissed, "Keep Tom under your eye. Don't let him do anything stupid. Cover his back at every moment." Abelly looked back at Hal with smoky dark eyes and did not deign to answer. Hal went on. "Don't let him begin the climb until we draw every man on top of the wall away to the east side." Abelly whispered back fiercely, "Do your work, Gondwani, and I will do mine. Go to it, then." Hal pushed him away lightly and watched the small party, Tom and Abelly, running shoulder to shoulder at its head, jog away, circling out through the forest to reach the far side of the fortress. As they disappeared, Hal looked up at the tops of the walls just showing above the trees ahead, and cocked his head to listen for sounds of the bombardment. Although this end of the island was wreathed in thick eddies of gun smoke and the taste of burnt powder was rank in the back of his throat, the thunder of the guns was fading away. Ned was taking the Seraph and the Minotaur out to safer waters. Hal looked back over his shoulder and saw that even after the long, hard run through the forest, the column of seamen was closing up behind him, with few stragglers. He led them on and found Big Daniel waiting at the edge of the trees. Across 150 paces of open ground, the white walls of the fort stood 50 feet high.
The arched gates were closed, heavy beams of mahogany reinforced by iron studs. There were no defenders in sight on the battlements. They must all be on the west wall, facing the sea. As the last shots of the bombardment died away, Hal heard their thin, distant cheers as they saw off the squadron of attacking ships. "We have them at a disadvantage," Hal told Big Daniel, "but we must work quickly if we are to keep the element of surprise." Behind him, the men of the column were still coming up, bowed under their loads. Sweating and panting, they flopped down and raised their water bottles, gulping down long draughts greedily. Hal strode among them, rallying them and sending them to take up their positions along the edge of the tree line. "Keep your heads down. Keep out of sight. See to your priming. But do not fire until I give the order." The teams carrying the 5 heavy powder kegs had fallen back to the rear of the column, but at last they came staggering up with each of the 50-pound kegs slung on a pole between 2 men. They stacked them under the palm trees, and Hal and Daniel set to work to prepare the fuses. Hal had cut slow match as short as he dared, and this was always a delicate business, for no 2 pieces of match would burn at the same rate. They tapped each length of fuse with the handle of a knife to try to spread the fulminate evenly. Then they threaded a fuse through the bunghole of each cask. Every second was precious now, and they could not spare time to make certain that each fuse was perfect. If one failed, there were 4 others to set off the explosives. "Ready?" Hal looked up from his task. Big Daniel plugged the final fuse in place with a handful of soft pitch. "Ready as we'll ever be." "Light the slow match," Hal ordered, and Daniel struck the flint with the steel. The tinder caught. One after the other, they touched a short length of slow match to the flame and watched it smoulder and smoke. "Shoulder the kegs," Hal ordered, and 5 fresh men, each chosen for his brawn, rose from where they had been squatting and came forward. Another rank was waiting behind them, ready to run forward and take up a keg if one of the porters was shot down by enemy musket fire from the walls of the fort. Hal drew his sword and strode to the edge of the forest. He peered from the cover across the open ground. There was still no sign of any defenders on the walls. He drew a deep breath and steeled himself. "Quietly, lads. Follow me." Without a shout or cheer, they ran forward in a group. The bare feet of the heavily burdened seamen sank deep into the sandy soil with each pace, but they covered the ground fast and were almost to the gates when there was a yell and a shot from the battlement above the gates. Hal saw a turbaned head in the stone opening and the muzzle of a smoking Jezel aimed down at them. The range was short, and the ball took one of the running seamen squarely in his naked chest. The wounded man sprawled full length in the sand, and the keg rolled from his shoulder. Big Daniel was running only a pace behind him, and he scooped up the keg as lightly as though it was a ninepin. With it tucked under his arm, he jumped over the dying man and was the first to reach the gates. He dropped the keg against the hinges and beckoned to the men coming up behind him. "Here! Bring them here!" As the first man came up, snorting and panting with the effort, Big Daniel snatched his burden from him. "Get back to the trees," he barked, and laid the keg beside the other. "Well done, lad." He grabbed the next keg and stacked it in a pyramid upon the first 2. By now a crowd of shrieking Arabs was on the battlements above them, and a ragged fusillade of musket shots rang out as Daniel's men tried to reach the cover of the tree line. Another was shot down and lay groaning in the open ground with spurts of dust kicking up around him as the musketeers on the wall tried to finish him off. From the trees the seamen hidden were opening answering fire. Their musket balls cracked against the stone blocks and rained chips of coral down on the men crouched at the foot of the massive gates. Hal knelt beside Big Daniel as he placed the 5th powder keg on top of the stack. He blew on the smouldering end of the slow match in his hand, and it flared up redly. "Get you gone, Danny," he told the big man. "I'll see to the rest of it." But Daniel had his own slow match smoking in his hand. "Beg your pardon, Captain, but I'll give you a hand to kiss the devil's daughter." He knelt beside Hal and touched the match to the fuse of one of the powder kegs. Hal did not waste words in argument and bent to the same task. Working without haste, they lit each of the 5 fuses and waited to make certain that they were burning evenly. By this time, half the garrison of the fort was swarming along the wall above them, firing as fast as they could reload into the edge of the forest. 400 British sailors were yelling and cheering and sending in a withering fusillade over the battlements. Hal and Daniel were protected from the fire of the men above them by the slight overhang below the battlements. But as soon as they left its shelter, they would be fully exposed during their return across the open ground. Hal took a last look at the furiously burning fuses. Only an inch or so protruded from the bunghole of each keg, and rose to his feet. "I think the time has come to leave." "I can see no reason to linger, Captain." Big Daniel grinned at him with his bald gums, and the two launched themselves side by side into the open. Immediately the shouts from the battlements behind them redoubled, and every Arab on the walls turned his fire upon the running pair. The heavy lead balls whirred about their heads and ploughed into the soft sand at their flying feet. From the trees the seamen yelled encouragement and fired as wildly as the Arabs on the walls. "Seraph!" they screamed. "Come on, Danny! Run for it, Captain!" Time seemed to slow down for Hal. It was as though he was underwater, each stride seeming to last many minutes. The line of the forest seemed to come no nearer, and the musket balls flew around them as thick as hail. Then Big Daniel was struck. Not once, but almost simultaneously by 2 balls. One hit him in the back of the knee, broke the bone, and his leg folded under him like a carpenter's rule. The second ball struck him in the hip and shattered the neck of the femur. He went down in the sand with both legs twisted and useless under him. Hal ran on 4 paces before he realized he was alone. Then he paused and looked back. "Go on!" Big Daniel yelled at him. "You can't help me! Both my legs are gone!" His face had dived into the sand, and his eyes and mouth were filled with it. Hal whirled and ran back to him through the storm of musket fire. "No! No!" Big Daniel bellowed, sand and spittle flying from his mouth in a cloud. "Go back, you fool! Go back!" Hal reached him and stooped to seize his shoulders. He tried to lift him and was appalled by the weight of the great body. With both his legs shot away, Daniel could not help him take the strain. Hal took another deep breath and readjusted his grip, then heaved up again. This time he lifted the top half of Daniel's torso clear of the ground and tried to get his shoulder under the other man's armpit. "It's no use!" Big Daniel gasped in his ear, swamped in agony, as the shattered bones in his hip grated against each other. "Go on! Save yourself!" Hal had no breath to reply. So he gathered the last ounce of his strength and lifted, straining with every sinew and fibre of his body. At the effort, his vision darkened and starred into whirling comets of light, but slowly Big Daniel's huge frame lifted clear of the sandy earth, and he threw his right arm round Hal's shoulders. They stood there for a long moment, locked together, unable to move another step. "You're mad," Big Daniel whispered, his lips an inch from Hal's ear. "The powder's going to blow." On the high battlements behind them, an Arab musketeer poured a handful of coarse black powder into the muzzle of his jezel and rammed down a wad on top of it. He was holding the ball between his teeth. It was an irregular lump of soft pig iron that he had hand-forged to a rough fit in the barrel. He spat the ball into the muzzle and used the long wooden ramrod to drive it home. Then he reversed the weapon and laid the forestock across the stone sill of the embrasure. With shaking fingers, he poured a fine stream of powder into the pan of the lock, snapped the frizzen closed, and drew back the hammer to full cock. Then he lifted the stock to his shoulder and peered down the long brass-bound barrel. He saw that out in the open ground the 2 infidels were still struggling helplessly, clinging to each other like lovers. He aimed carefully at their heads, which were close together, then pulled hard on the stiff trigger. The hammer dropped, and the flint struck a starburst of sparks from the steel to the frizzen. The powder in the pan ignited in a puff of white smoke, and for a moment it seemed that the jezel would misfire. But then, with a deafening bellow, it leapt in his hands, kicking the barrel head high. The beaten slug of pig iron started to tumble, end over end as soon as it left the muzzle. It whirred through the air to where Hal and Big Daniel were dragging themselves away. It had been aimed at Hal's head, but it dropped so sharply in flight that it almost missed him completely. In the end, it struck him with a loud thump on the side of his ankle, tore away his heel, and shattered the fragile bones of his left foot. As his foot was knocked out from under him, Hal dropped under Big Daniel's weight, and the two lay side by side, flat upon the ground.
"Run, in God's name," Big Daniel shouted into Hal's face. "The kegs are going up at any moment."
"I can't," Hal blurted through the pain. "I'm hit. I can't stand." Big Daniel heaved himself up on one elbow and looked down at Hal's foot. He saw at once that the wound was crippling, then glanced back at the pyramid of powder kegs under the arch of the gate only 30 yards from where they lay. One of the burning fuses reached the bunghole and flared brightly in the plug of soft pitch. It was on the point of exploding. Big Daniel seized Hal in a smothering bear hug and rolled on top of him, forcing his face into the soft earth, covering him with his own great body.
"Get off me, damn you!"
Hal struggled beneath him. But at that instant, the bottom keg blew up and set off an instantaneous sympathetic explosion in every one of the four others piled on top of it. 250 pounds weight of black powder was consumed in a single flash, and the blast was cataclysmic. It ripped the heavy doors from their hinges and blew their splintered beams across the courtyard beyond. It collapsed the stonework of the arch and brought the battlements tumbling down in an avalanche of coral blocks, mortar and dust. A score or more of the Arabs on the wall were brought down with it, crushed and buried in the rubble. The smoke and dust shot 200 feet straight up into the air, then boiled into the anvil head of a thundercloud. The shockwave blew out across the open ground in front of the walls and struck the edge of the forest, bringing heavy branches crashing down, bowing the palm trees and thrashing through their fronds like the winds of a hurricane. Big Daniel and Hal lay full in the path of the blast. It swept over them in a rolling wave of dust and debris. It sucked the air from their lungs and hammered them into the earth like the hoofs of a herd of stampeding buffalo. Hal felt his eardrums balloon, and the shock clubbed his brain. His senses were driven from him, and he seemed to hurtle through black space with the stars bursting in his head. He came back slowly from that faraway dark place, and his damaged eardrums roared and sang with the memory of that terrible blast. But through it he heard the thin, disembodied cheers of his seamen as they charged forward from the forest. In a pack, they raced past where he lay and reached the destroyed gateway. They scrambled and shoved each other over the piles of rubble that blocked it. Then they fought their way through the dust and the smoke and swarmed into the courtyard of the fort. With their cutlasses in their hands, giving tongue like a pack of deerhounds when the stag stands at bay, they fell upon the dazed defenders in a savage orgy of battle lust. Blinded with dust, Hal tried to sit up, but there was an immense weight on his chest that suffocated him and pinned him to the ground. He coughed, choked, and tried to blink the grit out of his streaming eyes. Though he clawed feebly at the huge slack body above him, he did not have the strength to free himself. Gradually, Hal's vision cleared, and the roaring in his ears faded to the buzz of a hive of bees trapped in his skull. He saw Big Daniel's face above him. His eyes were wide and staring, and his head rolled from side to side as Hal tried to push him off. His toothless mouth gaped open, and his tongue lolled. A mixture of his blood and spittle dribbled warm over Hal's cheek. The horror of it goaded Hal, and he made a supreme effort and wriggled out from under the great slack body. Groggily, he raised himself into a sitting position and looked down at the other man. By shielding him, Big Daniel had taken the full force of the blast. It had stripped away his clothing so that he was naked except for his boots and sword belt. The driven sand had blasted away the skin from his back and buttocks so that he looked like a freshly flayed deer. Chunks of stone and flying debris had ripped through his back and flanks,
exposing the white bone shards of his ribs and broken spine.
"Danny?" Hal called. "Danny, can you hear me?"
The question was futile, born of his own stunned senses. He tried to move closer to him, but found his own legs would not obey his will. He glanced down at them. They were the only part of his body that had not been protected by Daniel's. Both his legs had been stripped of the cloth of his breeches, and Hal saw that his flesh had been mangled as though caught in the iron teeth of a revolving capstan. Splinters of white bone protruded from the bloody mess. There was no pain, so his mind discounted the evidence of his eyes. He could not believe that he'd lost both his legs. He did not want to gaze upon that destruction any longer. Hal used his elbows now to drag himself closer to Big Daniel, digging them into the soft soil, and his shattered legs slithered along behind him. He lay beside the great body and gathered it in his arms. He rocked it gently, as once he had soothed his infant son to sleep.
"It'll be all right. We'll come through this together like we always do," he whispered. "It's going to be all right, Danny."
He did not realize that he was weeping until he saw his own tears falling into Daniel's upturned face, like warm drops of tropical rain, washing away the white grains of sand that coated the staring eyeballs. Dr. Reynolds, coming up through the grove with his two surgeon's mates, found them lying there.
"Take care of Danny first," Hal pleaded.
"God has already taken him into his care," Dr. Reynolds answered gently, and between them they lifted Hal onto the stretcher, with his legs dangling. Tom looked back over the bay. From where they lay at the top of a low white dune, he could see the two square-rigged ships a mile out beyond the reef, the graceful Seraph leading and the Minotaur with her black sails looking menacing and potent. As he watched, they tacked in succession and turned back into the south, taking up their blockade station across the mouth of the bay. Tom rose on one knee and stared over the top of the dune at the walls of the fort 200 paces away. The heavy mist of gun smoke was dissipating, blowing away on the monsoon wind, streaming out to sea. The top of the wall was lined with hundreds of heads, dark bearded faces below their kaffir headcloths and turbans. The defenders were brandishing their muskets and dancing on the ramparts in triumph. Tom could hear the excited jabber of their voices, and even understood some of their shouted insults aimed at the two English ships. "May God blacken the face of the infidel! God is great! He has given us the victory!" Tom started to rise to his feet. "Something has gone wrong. They should have blown the gates by now." Aberley reached up and seized his wrist. He drew him down to his side. "Steady, Klebe. Sometimes the cruelest part of the battle is the waiting." Then they heard musket fire from the far side of the fortress, and all the Arab heads along the breastworks turned in that direction. Their shouts and taunts died away.
"The infidel is attacking the gates!"
a voice screamed in Arabic, and there was an immediate stampede. Even the gunners deserted their cannon and raced away along the catwalk to counter this new threat. In seconds, the parapets were deserted, and Tom scrambled to his feet again.
"Now is our chance. Follow me."
Aboli pulled him down again.
"Patience, Klebe."
Tom struggled to break his grip.
"We can't wait any longer. We have to get Dorry."
Aboli shook his head.
"Even you cannot fight 1,000 men on your own."
Tom stared across at the loophole in the top of the wall, where he knew Dorian was incarcerated.
"He should have the sense to signal, to show us where he is. He should wave his shirt or something."
Then swiftly he made allowance for his brother.
"Oh, but he's only a baby. He doesn't always know what to do."
From the far side of the fort, the scattered sound of musket shots crescendoed into a furious fusillade.
"Listen, Klebe," Aberley restrained him. "Danny and your father are laying the charges under the gates. It will not be long now."
Then the blast stung their eardrums, and the thunder of the explosion stunned them. A tower of dust and smoke shot into the sky and boiled over at the crest, spreading out into a bulging thunderhead. The dust cloud was thick with hurtling debris, with lumps of rock and burning fragments that spun smoke trails against the blue.
Tom watched a brass cannon thrown 100 feet into the air. Human bodies and dismembered limbs were hurled even higher, along with heavy baulks of timber and other wreckage. Before Tom could recover his wits, Abberly was on his feet and loping away across the open ground towards the fort. Tom leapt up and charged after him, but the skirts of his robe hampered him, and he could not catch Abberly before he reached the foot of the wall. Abberly knelt and made a stirrup with his intertwined fingers. Without pausing, Tom placed one booted foot into it, and Abberly boosted him high into the branches of a strangler fig tree, whose roots were woven into the joints between the stone blocks. Tom climbed upwards like a monkey. Neither the sword scabbard banging against his legs, nor the brace of pistols thrust into his belt could slow him. Abberly and the three other men followed him up, but Tom reached the top of the parapet ahead of them. He scrambled into the gap where the wall had begun to collapse and threw his legs over the top. A startled brown face confronted him. One Arab had not been drawn away from his post by the tumult of the assault on the gates. With a shout of astonishment, he recoiled before Tom's sudden appearance and tried to level the musket in his hands. But the curved hammers hooked in a fold of his robe, and while he struggled to free them, the sabre flew from Tom's scabbard as though it was a bird. His thrust caught the man in the throat and severed his vocal cords so that his next shout was stillborn. He tottered backwards and dropped, arms flailing 50 feet into the courtyard behind him. While Abberly and the three seamen scrambled over the battlements, Tom cast a quick look around the walls of the courtyard of the fort. Through the thick billows of dust and smoke, he saw the indistinct shapes of the Arabs stumbling away from the ruins of the gateway. Along the catwalks at the top of the parapet, a wailing mob was fighting to get away from the smoking shambles that had been the gate to the fort. Then, through the shattered gateway, poured a yelling mob of English seamen. They struggled over the rubble and raced up the ramps to fall upon the Arabs on the walks of the ramparts. There were a few scattered musket shots, and Tom saw one seaman fall backwards down the ramp. Then the two sides met and became a confused mass of howling, hacking, fighting men. Tom looked for his father in the mob. Usually, Hal's height and his black beard distinguished him even in the worst melee, but Tom could not find him. However, he could not spare the time to search longer. "This way," he called, and led his party along the catwalk to the ramp furthest from the gate. Their robes disguised them, and the Arabs around them let them pass without a second glance. Tom went down the ramp at a run and reached the halfway landing unchecked. From there, an arched doorway opened into the interior. Two guards were at the entrance. One gawked at Tom's pale eyes and European features, then swung his scimitar above his head. "Ferengi!" he screamed, and swung a full-blooded cut at Tom's head with the curved blade. Tom ducked under it and riposted with a clean thrust high in the line of engagement, which went deep into the Arab's chest. As he withdrew his blade, the breath from the guard's punctured lungs whistled out of the wound, and he dropped to his knees. Abberly killed the other guard as swiftly. Then they jumped over the corpses and ran into the dark, narrow passage beyond. "Dorry!" Tom screamed. "Where are you?" He flung the robes back from his face and tore the turban from his head. He no longer needed the disguise, and he wanted Dorian to recognize him. "Dorian!" he cried again. His voice echoed weirdly along the passage and was answered by wild shouts in a babble of different languages. Along both sides of the passage were the entrances to a dozen or more cells. The original doors must have rotted away a half century ago, for they had been replaced by others of raw timber and crudely barred construction. Tom saw gaunt, bearded white faces peering through the openings and clawed hands reaching out towards him in supplication. He knew at once that these were the prisoners from the ships captured by Al-Auf. Dorian must be among them, and his spirits soared.
"Dorian!"
an English voice answered. "Jesus love you, sir. We have prayed for your coming." Abberly lifted the heavy locking bar from its brackets. The door burst open, and the prisoners forced their way out of the tiny stone cell into the passageway. Tom was almost trapped in the flood of ragged, stinking humanity, and fought himself clear, hurrying on to peer into other cells.
"Dorian!"
he bawled above the hubbub. He was trying to work out in which of the cells he had last seen his brother.
that he was uncertain of his bearings. He grabbed one of the released prisoners and shouted at him as he shook his shoulders, "Is there a young white boy here with red hair?" The man stared at him as though he was mad, then pulled himself free and ran to join the flood of released men streaming down into the courtyard. Tom reached the end of the passage and the last cell. The door was ajar, and he stepped into the tiny stone-walled room. It was empty. There was a mattress of dried palm fronds against the wall, but no other furnishing. The sunlight slanted in through the loophole set in the far wall, and Tom crossed to it quickly. He looked out at the sweep of the bay and the two ships lying offshore. "This is the one," he muttered. He jumped onto the step below the loophole and stuck his head through the opening. The liana grew up the outside of the wall, almost close enough to touch. "This is the cell they had Dory in. But where is he now?" He jumped down from the step and looked around the empty cell. Iron rings were cemented into the stone blocks to which men had been chained. The walls were covered with graffiti scratched into the soft coral. He read Portuguese names and dates 100 years old, worn and overgrown with moss and fungi. There were more recent additions in Arabic script, and he picked out a religious exhortation, a line from Surah 17 of the Quran, that he recognized because Alf Wilson had made him learn it by heart. "The seven heavens and the earth, and all things therein declare his glory." Below that there was another scratching made with a belt buckle or some other metal implement. It was fresh and raw, in lopsided, childish letters. "Dorian Courtney, 3rd of February, 1691.
"He was here!" Tom shouted aloud. "Abberley! Dorry was here!"
Abberley appeared in the doorway, blocking it with his massive dark body.
"Where is he now, Clebby?" "We will find him."
Tom paused only to rip off the constricting robe that hampered his movements and hurled it against the wall. Then they ran together back down the passage and out into the sunlight. The fighting was still surging through the courtyard below them and over the ramparts of the fortress, but at a glance it was obvious that the defenders were in rout. Hundreds had escaped through the shattered gateway. They had thrown away their weapons and were streaming into the forest. Others were trapped within the walls. Many were on their knees pleading for quarter, but Tom saw others leap from the ramparts rather than face the English cutlasses. With their white robes ballooning around their bodies, they shrieked as they plunged to earth. However, a few were still fighting. One isolated group of a dozen men was holding the east bastion and screaming their defiance.
"Allah Akbar! God is great!"
But as Hal watched, the Englishmen swarmed over them, cut them down, and threw their bodies over the battlements. Tom looked desperately for a small figure and a fiery patch of hair in the confusion. But there was no glimpse of his brother. A woman raced up the ramp towards Tom. Her black veil had blown away, and her head was uncovered. Tom saw that she was little more than a child. Her long black hair streamed back from her terrified face, and her cold, darkened eyes were those of a fawn pursued by the hounds. Shouting with excited laughter, four seamen followed her, their shirts soaked with the blood of the men they had killed, their faces speckled with bloody droplets, swollen and inflamed with lust. They caught the girl at the edge of the ramp and threw her down. Three pinned her to the stone flags, and though she struggled, they pulled up the skirts of her robe and exposed her slim brown limbs and her smooth, naked belly. The fourth sailor ripped open his breeches and fell on top of her.
"Grease the pink lane for us!" his mates encouraged him.
Tom had never imagined anything so horrific. As a novice of the Order of St. George and the Holy Grail, he had been taught that war was noble, and all true warriors were gallant. He ran forward to intervene, but Abberley seized his arm and held it in a grip of iron.
"Leave them, Clibby. It is the right of the victors. Our duty is now to Bomvu."
He used his pet name for Dorian, which meant red in the languages of the forests.
"We can't let them," Tom blurted. "We can't stop them," Abberley cut him short. "They will kill you if you try. Let us find Bomvu instead."
The girl was sobbing pitifully, but Abberley dragged Tom down the ramp to the ground level. At this end of the courtyard they found a maze of old walls and doorways. Some of the doors stood open, but most were heavily barred and the windows shuttered. Dorian could be behind any of those. Tom knew his little brother would be lost and terrified. They had to find him before he was hurt in the fighting and the looting. "Take the far end," he shouted at Abberley, pointing down the covered terrace. "I will start here." He did not look back to see if Abberley had obeyed him, but ran to the nearest door. It was locked. He tried to barge it open with his shoulder, then stood back and tried to kick out the massive iron lock. It stood solidly, resisting his attempts. Tom looked about him and recognized one of the topmastmen from the Seraph who was running down the terrace carrying a long-handled axe in one hand and a pistol in the other. His arms were bloody to the elbows and his expression was rapturous with the joy of battle. "Charlie!" Tom yelled at him, and even through the mists of fighting madness the man heard him. "Break this door in," Tom ordered. Charlie grinned at the invitation to further destruction. "Stand back, Tommy, me lad," he cried, and rushed at the door. With two mighty swings of the axe, he had dashed in the panels and sent the door sagging back on its hinges. Tom kicked it open the rest of the way and jumped through. He found himself in a labyrinth of small rooms and passageways. He ran forward, glancing into each room as he passed. Clearly they had all been hastily deserted. Bedding and clothing were thrown about in disarray. Suddenly he heard a loud thudding over his head and looked up a rickety staircase at the end of the passage. It sounded as though someone was trying to escape from a locked room. Perhaps it's Dorry. His heart pounded. Without another thought, Tom raced up the stairs, taking them two at a time. He reached the top and found a heavy door standing open, the huge iron key still in the lock. He ran through into a long, narrow room. The windows were shuttered, and it was in semi-darkness. "Dorry!" he shouted, as he looked about him quickly. He saw at once that this was no prison. Along the wall opposite the shuttered windows was packed an assortment of small wooden chests. They were very similar to the chests they had captured from the Dhow of Al-Malik, the chests that had contained the ransom money for Dorian. He realized that this must be one of Al-Awf's storerooms, probably the one where he kept his most valuable booty. Four of the chests stood open, the lids thrown back. Even in his concern for his brother, Tom was fascinated by the contents that were revealed. He recognized the typical Arab coin bags that filled them. He took up one and hefted it in his hand. The weight and the shape of the coins through the cloth dispelled any doubts he might have had. "Gold," he whispered. Then he noticed that someone had left a leather saddlebag on the stone floor beside the chest. It was half filled with the bullion sacks. He must have interrupted someone in the act of filling it before making his escape from the beleaguered fortress. The banging noises Tom had heard were of the chests being broken open. Whoever it was must still be here. As the realization dawned upon Tom, he heard the slither of a stealthy footstep on the stone flags behind him. The sound galvanized him, and he whirled towards the doorway. Al-Awf had hidden behind the open door when he heard Tom's running footsteps coming up the stairs, and now Tom recognized him instantly. He had seen him on the deck of the Minotaur as the Seraph engaged the Corsair. He was taller than Tom had thought, and his predatory eyes in their deep sockets were dark and fierce as those of a vulture. His head was bare. He wore no turban. His thick black tresses, laced with silver, fell to his shoulders and merged with the curls of his beard. His lips were drawn back in a savage grimace as he lifted the pistol in his left hand and aimed at Tom's head. For a fleeting moment, Tom looked deep into the gaping muzzle of the barrel, then into Al-Awf's bright eye, aiming at him over the sights of the pistol. With a metallic click that sounded deafening in the confines of the small room, the hammer fell and the pan flashed in a puff of white smoke. Tom winced as he waited for the ball to smash into his face. But it never came. The pistol had misfired. For an instant, Al-Awf was blinded by the smoke and the flash in the pan, and in that brief time, Tom had covered the space between them.
He had seen that the pistol was double-barreled, and that Alaouf's forefinger was hooking around the second trigger. He knew that luck could not favour him twice, and that the second barrel would kill him. He swung the sabre at the outstretched pistol hand, and the blade slashed across the inside of Alaouf's wrist. Like a razor, it opened the cluster of veins and arteries beneath the brown skin, and the pistol dropped from the nerveless fingers. Hilt first, it struck the stone floor, and with a vicious roar the second barrel fired. The ball splintered the wood of one of the bullion chests, and Alaouf reeled back, groping for the scimitar on the gem-encrusted belt around his waist. He cleared his blade just in time to counter the thrust that Tom sped at the centre of his sternum. Tom had not expected him to be so quick. The silver streaks in Alaouf's hair and beard had misled him. The corsair was leopard-fast, and the power in the blade was that of a man half his age. As Tom recovered from his thrust, Alaouf dropped on one knee and slashed backhanded for his ankles, a stroke that might have maimed him. Tom did not have time to recoil. Instead, he bounded into the air, and the curved blade flickered under the soles of his boots. Still airborne, Tom cut at the Arab's dark head, but Alaouf slipped away from him like a serpent sliding under a rock. He had left a puddle of blood on the stones, and his wrist was still spurting. Tom blocked the riposte and made a feint high in the tiers, but Alaouf countered and lunged under his blade, aiming for his stomach. Tom jumped back, and the thrust came up short. They circled, holding each other's eyes, trying to divine the other's thoughts. Their blades rasped and thrummed together as each probed for a weakness. Tom's foot slipped in the blood, and the moment he was off balance, Alaouf released himself like a bolt from a crossbow, going low again, trying for the hip. Tom deflected and forced him to scramble away. Tom was reading his man now. He was fast and elusive, and age had not eroded the strength in his wrist. If they continued fencing, then in the end Alaouf's experience would tell. Tom knew that he must turn it into a trial of strength. He swayed across the Arab's strong side, flirting with him, offering a fleeting opening, but as Alaouf accepted and thrust low again, Tom blocked his blade with a dead hit and trapped it with his own. Now they were almost chest to chest, their blades crossed at eye level. Tom put all the weight of his broad young shoulders into it, and Alaouf gave a step. Tom could feel the strength going out of him, dribbling from the open veins in his left wrist. Tom heaved again, but Alaouf was not as weak as he had pretended. He gave way so rapidly that Tom stumbled forward against no resistance, and again Alaouf went low. Tom should have read it, for he knew his man well enough by now to guard against the low thrust. It was only by a miracle of speed and cat-like balance that he swayed his lower body aside, and the thrust grazed his thigh. It split the stuff of his breeches and opened a shallow cut in the rubbery muscle of his leg. It was not a damaging wound, and at the end of his thrust, Alaouf was at full extension. As he tried desperately to recover, Tom gathered up his blade and forced him into a rolling engagement. The two swords swirled together, the sound of steel on steel screeching so shrilly as to set their nerves on edge, their hilts vibrating in their hands. Tom had succeeded at last in making it a straight trial of strength, for Alaouf dared not try to disengage. To do so, he must open his guard, and he knew the riposte would come like a lightning bolt. This was the classic prolonged engagement, which Tom had learned from Abeli. "With this coup, your father killed Schroeder," Abeli had told him, "and that Dutchman was the greatest swordsman I have ever seen wield a blade, after your father, that is." Tom leaned all his weight into his wrist, and Alaouf gave a pace. Round and round the two blades swirled, and sweat broke out across the brown forehead, which by now was deeply creased with effort, and streamed down into the eyes and beard. Triumphantly, Tom felt the other man weakening. The blood still fell in heavy drops from his wound, and Alaouf's lips twisted into a horrid rictus of despair. Dismay and death bloomed in his eyes. Suddenly, Tom changed the angle of his wrist. The point of his sword flashed an inch from Alaouf's eyes, and he broke. Against the Arab's will, his long brown fingers opened
and the hilt of his scimitar slipped from them. Tom used his own blade to pluck it away, and with a flick of his wrist hurled it against the far wall, where it fell and clattered onto the stone floor.
Al-Auf tried to duck and dart to the doorway, but Tom had the point of his sword in his beard, probing gently up under his chin, and he forced him back against the wall. Tom was panting deeply, and it took him a while to recover his breath sufficiently to speak.
"There is only one thing that you can do now to save your own life," he said between ragged breaths.
Al-Auf's eyes narrowed as he heard the infidel speak his own language so fluently.
"You can give me the Frankish boy you are holding here."
Al-Auf stared at him. He held his injured arm against his chest, trying to staunch the bleeding by squeezing his wrist with his other hand.
"Answer me," Tom said, and pressed the sword point deeper into his throat. "Speak to me, you offspring of a diseased sow. Give me the boy, and I will let you live."
The Arab winced at the prick of the steel.
"I do not know this child of whom you speak." "You know him well, the one with red hair," Tom interrupted his protests.
Al-Auf twisted his lips into a mocking smile.
"Why do you want Al-Amhara, the red one?" he said, and there was a terrible hatred in his eyes. "Was he your bum boy?"
Tom's sword hand trembled with anger at the insult.
"Al-Amhara is my brother."
"Then you are too late," Al-Auf gloated. "He has gone where you will never find him." Tom felt as though an iron hoop was tightening around his chest. His breathing came short.
Dorian was gone?
"You are lying." In his distress, the Arabic words tripped his tongue.
"I know he is here. I saw him with my own eyes. I will find him." "He is not on this island. Search where you will."
Al-Auf laughed now, a painful twisted sound. Tom cut it short with the pressure of the steel point. He stared into the Arab's dark eyes, and a confused jumble of thoughts raced through his brain.
"No." Tom did not want to believe it. "You are hiding my brother here. You are lying."
But there was something in Al-Auf's manner that warned Tom he was telling the truth. He knew they had lost little Dorry. And slowly, black despair filled the empty place that Dorry had left in his heart. He lowered the sword blade from Al-Auf's throat and turned away. He started towards the door, desperate to search every corner of the island, if merely to set his heart at rest. Al-Auf was so surprised that for a moment he stood rigid. Then he dropped his uninjured right hand to the hilt of the curved dagger in the gold filigree scabbard on his belt. The burnished blade made a small slippery sound as it slid from its sheath. Tom was not too far gone in misery to ignore that fatal whisper, and as he spun around to face him, Al-Auf launched himself across the gap between them with the dagger raised above his head to plunge it into Tom's back. At that treachery, Tom's despair turned to a consuming rage. He jumped forward to meet the attack and drove his sword point into the centre of the Arab's chest. He felt the steel glance off a rib, then slide through the heart and lung, and thrill in his grip as the point hit the spine. Al-Auf froze, and the dagger dropped from his hand. It clattered loudly on the floor, and the hatred in his black eyes faded. Tom placed one booted foot against the man's chest and pushed him backwards as he pulled the red blade free. Al-Auf slumped to his knees, and his head drooped forward. But Tom's rage was not yet assuaged. He lifted the sabre high and swung it down again, using the full power of his shoulders, his arm, and the snap of his wrist, so that the blade hissed in the air as it descended. It fell across the back of Al-Auf's neck. The head toppled from the spouting stump, struck the floor with a meaty thump, and rolled to Tom's feet. Tom stared down into Al-Auf's face. The dark eyes were wide open and fierce. His lips opened, and it seemed he tried to speak, but then his lids fluttered, the light went out of his eyes, which turned dull and opaque, and his jaw went slack.
It is done. And well done, said Abeli from the doorway. He stepped into the room and slipped off the Arabic gown he wore. He knelt and spread the garment on the floor, then lifted the severed head by a handful of its lank black hair. Tom watched him as he wrapped Al-Auf's head in the cloak. He felt little emotion and no remorse as the blood soaked through the folds of the cloth. Abeli stood up and slung the gruesome bundle over his shoulder. We will take it to your father. Al-Auf's head is worth a barony to him when he presents it to the governors of the Honourable Company in London. With the naked sword in his hand, Tom followed Abeli like a sleepwalker down the passage and out into the sunlight. He felt no elation, only the crushing weight of the knowledge that he had lost Dorian forever. Tom pushed his way through the excited seamen who rampaged through the passages and inner rooms of the fort. They were guffawing and shouting loud banter at each other as they ransacked the building. Every so often there was a shout and a scream as they found another Arab hiding in one of the cells and dragged him out into the courtyard. The prisoners were stripped naked. The seamen had learned how readily they could conceal a dagger under their voluminous robes. Even the women were treated in this way. The captured weapons were thrown in a pile in the centre of the courtyard, while the valuables, the purses of the men and the gold jewellery of the women, were thrown on a spread canvas sail. Then the prisoners were dragged away to join the ranks of naked brown bodies that already knelt along the north wall of the courtyard, guarded by grinning sailors with pistols cocked and cutlasses drawn. Tom strode across to the ranks of squatting Arabs and picked out one. Despite his nudity, the man had noble features and an intelligent, dignified gaze. "What is your name, old father?" Tom asked, making an effort to keep his address respectful. The old man looked startled to be spoken to in Arabic, but he responded to Tom's gentle tone. "My name is Ben Abram." "You have the look of a scholar or a holy man," Tom flattered him. Again the old man responded. "I am a physician. There was a boy here on the island. He would now be 12, with red hair. He was captured by Al-Auf. Do you know him?" "I know him," Ben Abram nodded, and Tom's spirit soared. "He is my brother. Where is he now? Is he here on the island?" he demanded eagerly. But Ben Abram shook his head. "He is gone. Al-Auf sold him into slavery." At last Tom had to accept this corroboration of Al-Auf's boast. For a minute he thought that he would not be able to bear the pain of it. "Where did they send him? What is the name of the man who bought my brother as a slave?" Ben Abram shook his head again, but his eyelids slid away from Tom's face and his expression was guarded. "I do not know," he whispered. Tom knew he was lying, and his hand went to the hilt of his sword. He would force it out of the old man, but then he saw the strong, determined set of Ben Abraham's features, and his intuition warned him that he would get nothing from him by force. To give himself time to think, he looked around the inner walls of the fort. Dead Arabs were scattered along the ramparts, with many wounded among them, who groaned and writhed in the dirt. He called across to the coxswain, who was in command of the guard. "This man is a surgeon. Give him back his clothes and let him tend to the enemy wounded." "Aye, Mr. Courtney," the man knuckled his forehead. Tom turned back to Ben Abram. "Many of your men need your care. You may go to them." "May Allah reward your compassion." Ben Abram rose to his feet and pulled on the robe that the coxswain tossed to him. Tom watched the old man hurry away and kneel beside one of the badly wounded Arabs at the foot of the ramp. Now he must find his father and tell him the dread news he had learned of Dorian. Tom looked about him again, then started towards the gate. As he went, he stopped every crewman from the Seraph he recognized. "Have you seen the captain? Where is he?" When none could answer, Tom felt concern well up in him. Then he saw Captain Anderson near the devastated gateway. Anderson was bright red in the face and roaring like a wounded bull, trying to get his rampaging troops organized into gangs to start retrieving the contents of the storerooms in which the pirate booty was stored.
Already some sailors were staggering out of the fort under the weight of bales and barrels to stack them beside the gate, ready to be carried down to the beach and loaded aboard the waiting ships. Tom pushed his way to Anderson's side. Anderson swiveled to face him, and his expression softened in a way that puzzled Tom. "I have killed Auf." Tom raised his voice to make himself heard above the uproar. "Aberley has his head." Tom indicated the tall black man and the blood-stained bundle he carried slung over his shoulder. "Mother Mary," Anderson looked mightily impressed. "That's good work. I was wondering where that rascal had vanished to. His head will be worth a luck in London. There's a room full of bullion chests at the head of the stairs behind that doorway at the end of the ramparts. The good Lord only knows how much gold Al-Auf has squirreled away there. Captain Anderson, I believe it best that you send a reliable officer to guard it before our lads begin helping themselves." Anderson shouted for his coxswain and gave the orders. With five hastily recruited men, the officer hurried away, and Tom could ask the question that had been burning his tongue. "Have you seen my father, Captain? I've been searching for him. He should be here to help you take command." Anderson looked down at him, and his eager expression melted with pity. "He's down, lad. I saw him struck by the blast of the powder explosion at the gates." As this premonition of disaster was realized, Tom felt his heart clutched by the icy hand of dread. "Where is he, sir?" "The last I saw of him, he was in front of the gates." Anderson's voice was gruff with sympathy. "I'm sorry, lad. But from what I saw, he is almost certainly killed." Tom fled from him, even Dorian forgotten at that moment. He scrambled over the piles of rubble that blocked the gateway and saw one shattered body lying out in the open ground. He ran and dropped to his knees beside it. It was so badly mangled, stripped of its clothing, the skin flayed away from the raw flesh, that Tom could not be sure whom he was looking at. Gently he turned the shattered head. "Danny," he said softly, and felt the tears start in his eyes. He had not known how much he had loved the big man until now. He blinked back the tears. Close up, death was uglier than his worst nightmares. Big Daniel's eyes were open and staring, clustered with blue flies. Tom brushed them away and stroked the lids closed with the palm of his hand. He stood up again uncertainly and found Aberley beside him. "Where is my father? Captain Anderson said he was here." Tom could see no other body that might have been his father's. There were 30 or 40 dead Arabs lying along the edge of the forest, killed as they tried to escape. A few seamen were picking over the corpses, making certain they were not feigning death, a favourite Arab trick, and searching them for anything of value. "Your father is not here," Aberley said. "They must have taken him away." Tom ran to the nearest seaman, who was squatting beside a body. Tom did not recognize him. He must have been off the Yeoman of York. "Have you seen Sir Henry, the captain of the Seraph?" The man looked up at him. "Aye, lad. The old man was sore wounded. I saw the sawbones take him off down to the bay." He gestured with his cupped hands full of gold jewelry. Over the tops of the trees, the masts of the squadron showed. As soon as the flags had been hoisted on the ramparts to announce the capture of the fort, all three ships had come into the bay. Tom took the pathway through the trees and ran down through the soft white coral sand. He came out on the beach, with Aberley only a pace behind him, and looked across at the tall ships lying at anchor in the clear, tranquil waters of the lagoon. The small boats were already busy ferrying between the vessels and the beach, bringing ashore those men who had been freed from their shipboard duties. Tom saw a longboat coming from the Seraph and hailed it as soon as its keel hit the sand. "Where is the captain?" "He's on board already, Master Tom," the boatswain shouted back. "I must go to him. Take me out to the ship." "Right you are, Master Tom. Jump aboard." When the longboat bumped against the Seraph's hull, Tom was the first man up the ladder, with Aberley still close behind him.